So we've talked about the benefit of beginner's mind, open, receptive, not knowing. I was about to talk about the 84,000 teachings and associated practices and the attitude we need to have in approaching those, because it's vital that we touch these teachings and practices with a light touch and understand that we're going to set aspirations for how we sit, how we learn, and we're going to fall on our face time and time again. In fact, basically the way meditation works is that we fall down and we get back up, and we fall down and we get back up. And if we continue old habits of mind, then we judge ourselves negatively. We blame ourselves for being stupid. We feel guilty for not getting the practices. In other words, we're reinforcing the very poisons that we want to liberate ourselves from. So the lesson here is forgiveness starts at home. Tolerance starts at home. If you're serious about entering the stream of the Dharma in terms of study and practice, you will be making mistakes all the time, and that's how you learn. So we have to be very positive and accepting of that with ourselves. The third point, besides beginner's mind and a lot of self-forgiveness, is that spiritual change takes place in the present moment. And actually, as we come to understand impermanence, really bringing the understanding of impermanence into our very core, we're left with nothing but the present. So as we bring in the understanding, the total integration of the concept of impermanence into our very core, presence becomes all that's left. It's a little bit of a koan, but I think you can see how as you totally understand the impermanent nature of all things, that everything is arising, abiding, and going away instantly, then all that's left is the present moment. The future is just a current thought about some hypothesized thing in the future. The past is just a present thought. Past and future can be dealt with fairly freely in something that's called the natural freedom of consciousness. If you're present and if you're accepting impermanence, then we can be present and conscious, and we can consciously think about something in the future without being lost to it. So we're still present. We can consciously think about something in the past, not be lost to it, still present. Or we can lose our consciousness and drift away into some fantasy about the future, which usually involves fear, into the past, which often involves guilt or remorse. The question is, are we present or not? Which means, are we conscious or not? So then we can start to explore what impermanence actually means. And the four foundations of mindfulness give us a framework. Are our bodies permanent? Does anyone have the same body they had as a child, even a year ago, even a day ago, even an hour ago? Every time we pee or poop or even breathe out, parts of our body are gone from us. There's nothing about the body that's permanent. Similar, the sensations, the second foundation of mindfulness, sensations, perceptions, feelings, constantly changing. Frank has taught us about what's called the Vednas, the very first contact with anything that arises, and it's before thought even, it's positive, negative, or neutral. So we're always changing our response to the environment, positive, negative, neutral, and on the next level up, it's like, dislike, or neutral about it. And then those are the first insights that arise for us, in fact, in this path, that our response, both physical and emotional, to the environment is constantly changing. Then we look at the mind. Does anyone have the same thoughts they had a year ago? Does anyone have the same beliefs they strongly held as a child or as a teenager, young 20s? Any of those beliefs still strongly held? Similarly, phenomena, and the physicists today have taught us clearly that all phenomena are just arising and changing and going away. In fact, when the physicists have really bored down to see what's there, it's probabilities. So why is this all important? And why do we go over something that gives Buddhism a bad name, which is that it seems so gloomy? It's been shown, and can be shown easily, that by refusing to accept the impermanent nature of ourselves and everything else in our life, what arises is a sense of insecurity and fear. And because of that, we cling. And through the clinging to something which isn't even really there, nothing is permanent, nothing is solid, but we cling anyway because of insecurity. And that's the cause of our suffering. Because in order to feel secure, we cling to things and to people and to activities and to the very act in America perfected busyness. We cling to these things because of this unconscious fear of insecurity, which is based on the very real fact that everything is going away as fast as it arises. It scares us. We don't really want to think about it. I remember very clearly a woman who had just learned that she had a few weeks to live saying, "I never thought this would happen to me." Which shows the extent of our denial of this basic truth. The Buddha was so adamant about this that he made it really one of the hallmarks, the cornerstones, most important principles in all of his teachings, that we have to understand impermanence. We have to accept it as the truth of everything. And we have to integrate it into our daily life. Because to the degree that we don't, we're in denial. And to the degree we're in denial, we're grasping at all of the things that we think can make us secure. And hence our suffering. Any questions so far about this gloomy topic?
Impermanence and ephemeral are synonymous.
I'm sorry, what?
Impermanence and ephemeral.
They're closely related, yes. In fact, there's a progression, so I'm glad you really brought that up. The first step in the progression is just our responses, the Vednas and then the poisons. Like, dislike, attached, push away. The second insight is why all of that's going on, and that's because things are constantly changing and our response to them is constantly changing, the insight of impermanence. Through that comes the insight of non-self, that what we consider to be this self isn't really anything solid and real. Different words have been used for it, but the most common word is that it is imputed. It's a concept. We figure that we must have a self because there's a lot of evidence that there is. We look in a mirror, we see something. I think, therefore, I am. People react to us as if we're truly here. And in fact, we can't deny all of those things. They're very real. But when we try to find the essence of ourselves, it's already changed. It's already arising and going away as we look at it. Heisenberg was right. So selflessness, non-self, is the next level of insight. And the next level of insight beyond that is emptiness, the core insight the Buddha wanted us to get, but which is so hard to grasp that it's worth getting there via impermanence. When you really get impermanence, you get the truth of suffering, two sides of one coin. All the teachings on suffering are also the other side of the coin of the teachings on impermanence. All the teachings on emptiness depend on the understanding of impermanence. So impermanence is the royal doorway to the understanding of emptiness. And you'll know when you've really got impermanence, because suffering is then gone. Doesn't mean that pain is gone. We use the old AA reminder about pain being inevitable and suffering being optional. You get a feeling for what I'm talking about here. We will be sorry when our loved ones depart before us. We will be sorry when we lose our fortune or our home or our whatever that we're clinging to, our friends, our lifestyle. If we're living in other parts of the world, our city, our nation, whatever, we'll be sad. But a Buddha can feel these emotions and not suffer in that way that's being referred to in AA, because the Buddha has completely incorporated the truth of impermanence. This is a tall order. I'm giving you some lofty concepts. So the teachings go on, further giving Buddhism a bad name, that the easiest way to approach this is through a constant contemplation of our death. And Buddhists are famous for constantly thinking about death. But Buddhists aren't the only ones. I brought a quote to back me up on this. Many of you have heard about the Renaissance French philosopher named Montaigne. He was born in 1533. And he wrote a brief essay, the first line of which is, "There is no place on earth where death cannot find us." Then he goes on to say, "Men come and they go, and they trot and they dance, and never a word about death. All well and good, yet when death does come, to them, their wives, their children, their friends, catching them unawares and unprepared, then what storms of passion overwhelm them, what cries, what fury, what despair. To begin depriving death of its greatest advantage over us, let us adopt a way clean contrary to that common one. Let us deprive death of its strangeness. Let us frequent it. Let us get used to it. Let us have nothing more often in mind than death. We do not know where death awaits us, so let us wait for it everywhere. To practice death is to practice freedom. A man who has learned how to die has unlearned how to be a slave." So this group was founded via hospice. And in the early days, when Frank was, because of certain other circumstances, not being able to stress the Buddhist part of this very much, he could easily talk about the Buddhist teachings through the gateway of hospice, death, and dying. And if you can do what Montaigne just suggested and constantly think about your death, then you can be curiously and actually curiously joyfully free. Because freedom from fear is probably the greatest freedom there is. If you're free from fear, then you're secure by definition. There's a poet who reflects that. Some of you know Galway Kinnell. And he wrote a poem called Pure Balance, where he touches on this. Wherever we are is unlikely. Our few kisses, I don't know if they're of goodbye or what, or if she knows either. Neither do I understand why it's exhilarating, as well as the other things it is, to know one doesn't have a future, or how much longer one won't have one. That's enough from that poem. A lot of Dharma practitioners have gone through phases of experience in practice. One of the first is a calmness, very common. Many of you have experienced it after meditating for a while. There's just kind of a calmness that you didn't have before, which is the first hint of this. And then practitioners who really, really work impermanence and really, really work the understanding, the constant inevitability, the ever-looming reality of death, start to feel kind of exhilarated by it. Not in a sense of seeking death. I think it's actually more accurately an exhilaration of the freedom which comes on that deep level when we do as Montaigne said and beat it to the punch. Not in trying to kill ourselves, but in trying to deprive it of its surprise advantage. Another teacher said, think of all the things that you've ever been, all the ways you've ever been, all the things you've ever thought, all the actions you've ever taken, everything you've owned, everyone you've loved. Think of it going away, and then relax into that, because that is what you will die into. That is Buddha nature, that total presence, that total lack of clinging. It's a difficult thing to think about, because even though on the one hand we all know, oh yeah, everything is impermanent, the fact that we still suffer is the reminder to us that we haven't really integrated it yet. We still think that we can do things to be secure on the one hand, and it doesn't mean that we shouldn't save some money and have a roof over our heads and have a good job. It's just the attachment and the underlying fear that we can start to recognize and let go of. Even though we think we understand impermanence, if we are unconsciously busy trying to distract ourselves through the busyness of modern life, never really standing still long enough to do these contemplations of impermanence and death, that's a reminder to us that we're running from something that these poets and philosophers are hinting at. So part of Buddhist practice, should you wish to embark on the Dharma, is to make impermanence, the understanding of impermanence, the truth of impermanence, the investigation of impermanence, the contemplation of impermanence, part of your daily life, and not just for the sitting meditation, because the sitting meditation is more of an experiential thing. We just put ourselves down here and we see what comes up. But in our day-to-day activities, we can always look for impermanence, the arising and briefly abiding and then dissolving of everything. Body, responses, thoughts, feelings, phenomena. Another teacher once said, contemplate this. When the world has ended, where will there be all of the thoughts and feelings and emotions and hopes and fears and philosophies and beliefs of all the human beings who ever lived? Where will those things be? So if we can understand the truth of impermanence, suddenly we're in the moment. And in that opening, we get a glimpse of Buddha nature, which is selfless, timeless, and emptiness. Simply through that constant contemplation of impermanence. So what we think we know and understand and say, oh yeah, I know everything's impermanent, as we bring it down deeper and deeper and look for it everywhere, and as we see it, relax into it rather than push it away in fear, these other insights arise. This is part of the process the Buddha himself went through. That culminated in that night under the Bodhi tree when there was this kind of cascading of ahas. For most of us, the ahas come more spaced out and take some work. But, you know, he put in a tremendous amount of work. And he had more than his 10,000 hours of meditation by the time the Bodhi tree came around. So there's a lot of ways that we can approach the truth. And there's a lot of aids. The metta practice is an aid. The practices of presence coming into the body are an aid. There are 84,000 teachings and associated practices according to the Buddhist lore. Find what fits. Be gentle with yourself. Be very forgiving when you get it wrong. Because you will. It's the getting it wrong and then correcting that is the process of learning. But if you can stomach this, look for impermanence everywhere. Look for death everywhere. Look for the truth of your own death everywhere. Savor it, contemplate it, try to understand it, and then relax into it. Letting go. I think I've said enough. I thought about some dyad practice where we could repeat, where we could ask each other repeating questions, but I think it might be better just to do it on your own and instead use this time for questions. So the question that I would have had in dyad practice, the repeating question, would be, what am I doing to hide from the truth of impermanence? What am I clinging to pretend things are permanent? What am I doing to feel secure? What am I clinging to feel secure? Questions like that. Just constantly asking yourself. Or just constantly checking. Is there anything permanent here? Is this anger I have at this person permanent? Is this attachment going to last? Is this busyness going to keep me from dying? This is inquiry, where the rubber hits the road in our every activity. And through that inquiry, insights arise. The insights of our changing response, to all things inner and outer, the insight of impermanence, the insight of the illusory nature of an individual permanent self, and the insight of emptiness. It just comes when you do this kind of work. The teachings help it come. Some of these ancillary practices we've been taught help it come. They're all laying the groundwork. That's why we do the practice. So, any questions? Yeah.
For those of us that are brand new.
Congratulations.
I hear it's a good place to be.
It is.
What are some examples of some of these in the moment inquiries that we can do as I go about my busyness? Where this is great, the meditating and the sitting is great, but I am looking to integrate it more into what I do. So I'm just looking for guidance as far as good ways to do that.
Good question. For the purpose of the recorder, let me make sure I got it right. What are some of the actual practices and contemplations we can use off the cushion in what's called post-meditation activity that will allow us to understand or contemplate emptiness? Is that right?
Yeah.
It's a wonderful question. In Buddhism, it's taught that beyond these initial neurologic preconscious responses of positive, negative, and neutral. You know, positive when we pet some furry animal, negative when we touch a hot stove, neutral when it's kind of not even registering. The next step up is like, dislike, indifferent. And the next step up are the poisons, attachment, clinging, aversion, pushing away, or ignorance, you know, not even thinking about it. So we look at the poisons for these contemplations that you're referring to. Look where you're attached. Investigate the attachment. Is this thing, person, hairstyle, image in the mirror permanent? Where will it be in 50 years? Will it be the same in 10 years? I'm attached to how my face looks. For example, when I'm 25 and getting ready to go out on a date, you know, what's it going to look like in 20 more years? Similarly, look to the other poison, the second major one, aversion. When you have an enemy, is that person automatically always going to be a bad, horrible human being? Is that person intrinsically a bad, horrible human being? Is there a possibility that in 20 years that person might save you from falling off a cliff and be your best friend? We've all had the experience that friends and enemies change. That's another one. Look at what you're really obsessed by getting. Look how getting ready to buy a new car, or a new boat, or a new backpack, or a new article of clothing can be so engaging. My teacher's teacher talked about cars by saying simply, rust waiting to happen. And indeed, we can all remember having finally gotten the thing that we had obsessed about and longed for, and a year later, we don't even think about it as we're scraping the ice off of it or fixing the bent fender. You know, it's more of an aggravation than anything else, especially when we get the mechanics bill. So that's not permanent either. Also look at the things that you're totally indifferent to and ask if you'll always be indifferent to them, or the things you're ignorant of. It's harder here because you don't know what you don't know, but you can always have the idea that you might know something new in 10 years. We've all had the experience that our firmly held belief looks silly to us now, a bit embarrassing actually. These are the ways we practice in daily life. It's a great piece of good fortune to have a fight with a colleague at work and watch what comes up. This is a horrible person. I hate this person. I don't ever want to see this person again. And find a year later that they're your best friend. So you can do contemplations around that. The universe is kind. It gives us a lot to work with. Similarly, the horrid things. When a loved one dies, it's a reminder. So there have been reminders lately in my life. There's a Tibetan story about a rich man, a merchant. Tibet in the old days was divided up into valleys. The valley was the whole universe in many ways. And this rich man, a trader, was on one side of the valley, and the monastery was on the other side, and the head lama there was kind of the priest for the whole area, the wise man. And the rich man talked to him, and he said, look, I'm too busy to practice the Dharma, but I will support your monastery very generously if you promise to tell me, to warn me before I die. Tell me I'm going to die. Lama said, sure. Good deal. So, a year or two went by and nothing from the lama. And then a horseman rode up one day to this guy's place of commerce and said, the lama sent me to tell you that Joe Smith down the road is dying. And the businessman thought, well, that's odd. Got kind of irritated. That's not what I asked for. Went about his work. And a couple of years later, another horseman came from the lama saying, Dorothy over there in the next village is dying. Now the businessman was kind of irked, but too busy to deal with it. And then he was dying. And he called the lama, and the lama showed up. And the businessman just lit into him. I gave you all this money, and your part of the deal was to let me know when I was going to die. And you can guess the answer. The lama said, well, I sent two messengers. I've had two messengers in the last week. Two of my colleagues have died. Two of my former colleagues. Very beloved person in Coeur d'Alene, and another very prominent person here. Suddenly, no warning at all. 5 minutes before these people were dead, they did not know they were going to be dead. That's why we practice death meditation. That's why the lama was sending the horses. There's another teaching on this, to answer your question further. One of my teachers, an American woman who had been in the Dharma a long time, said that everybody is surprised and bummed when bad things happen, when things don't go right. She said it's upside down. We should be really surprised when things do go right. And I've thought about that all the time now for the last couple of decades. We should be surprised when things go right. Because when you look at the odds of things going the way we like them to go, they're pretty slim. Unless our likes and wants are very, very simple. There's another Tibetan saying about how there are infinitely more things that exist in the universe to end your life than to prolong your life. Which is akin to this woman's teaching, that we should be surprised when things go right. Another contemplation on impermanence. Good question.
Thank you.
Did that answer it?
Yeah, it was a great answer. Thank you, Derek.
Question. So, you're saying, so things happen, hard things happen, so you're sad about it, versus suffering is when you just keep going and ruminating and getting stuck in it.
Yeah. Oh, woe is me. How could this have ever happened? I never thought anything like this would happen. Rending our clothes and tearing our hair and feeling personally affronted by it. Why is the universe treating me this way? Our stories go that way when we're suffering. Mine do anyway. Everything happens. You were given a body. The body is going away. Impermanence isn't something that happens in the future. It's happening right now. Your body is going away right now. Why wait to grieve when you're on your deathbed and be all upset about it? As Montaigne says, why not beat it to the punch?
Mm-hmm. Meaning that contemplate your death versus being surprised by it at the end?
Yeah. You absolutely know you're going to die.
Right.
But one of the great lines in the Bhagavad Gita, which is untold thousands of years old, is that the most wondrous thing of all is that every person will die and nobody truly believes he or she will die. We all kind of do this to it.
Yeah, I'm rereading a book that had a profound effect on me in the 70s, The Denial of Death by Ernest Pepper. In it, that's the total premise of the book, from Pharaoh to Donald Trump to about every behavior that we have in a sense of denial of death. Even Facebook these days, it's a denial. It's an attempt to make permanent the evidence of ourselves.
Exactly. The denial of death is the attempt to make permanent, the sense of self. You raised one other question, though. This is a good question about the difference between pain and suffering. It's normal to have emotions. Buddhas have emotions. It's what makes us human. It's related to the Vedanas. It's normal to withdraw when you touch the hot stove. You know, it's normal to be sad when a loved one dies. But if part of that sadness is surprise, or the story, how could this have happened, then we've missed the boat. It would be more accurate, more a part of Buddhist practice, to be surprised every time you see that person still alive. To be totally overjoyed every time you see your child at the breakfast table.
So, you know, I had, when I was separating from my ex-husband, and I would walk along the bike path, and there was this guy, kind of scruffy looking, and every time I saw him, and I could be in a really bad mood, he said it was a beautiful day. And it was one of the greatest things I had this summer. It was like, I don't know what it was. It was like, no matter the weather or my mood or whatever, he always reminded me it was a beautiful day. It's just, it's really cool.
It's one of the ways to contemplate impermanence is to practice joy. That what is arising, a beautiful day, even if it's raining. Because as you're dying, you might wish you could have one more day to enjoy a spring rain. You might wish you had one more day to be at the office with all those irritating people who you secretly love, you know? Who knows? So enjoy it now. Beat death to the punch. Montaigne really had it right. We can do ourselves a great favor. And through that favor, we're also planting the seeds that ripen into these profound insights, like the insight of emptiness, the insight of Buddha nature, the actual experience of these things, grow out of the seeds that we plant with these very contemplations. And you do those off the cushion, moment by moment. On the cushion, we're practicing presence, how to just be present. We're practicing non-attachment, how to let go of our very sticky thoughts and feelings, hopes and fears. Those are hard things to do, so they're best done on the cushion. It's too hard to try to practice them at work. So we practice those things on the cushion, and we practice these other contemplations at work and with family. And we try to immerse ourselves in this practice. It's moment by moment, really. It's a tall order, and we will fail all the time. And we forgive ourselves for that failure and see what we can learn about why did we fail? What are we attached to? What are we aversive to?
You said that impermanence is the gateway to emptiness. Is it silly to ask what emptiness looks like?
No, it's not silly, but I can't really tell you. It can only be experienced. There's lots of words written about emptiness. There's one book that you could kill an elephant with, looking at emptiness. You know, it's just so thick and heavy. All you can do is talk around it. And the more words there are, the more it starts to sound like philosophy. We will spend more time eventually talking about it. We're kind of laying the groundwork now. But if you spend the next few years contemplating death and impermanence, you'll get very much closer to actually experiencing it. And then when you hear a teaching on it, you'll go, ah. Whereas right now, if you hear a teaching on it, you'll say, what in the world is that all about? Our concepts get in the way. Our concepts are another beautiful practice of impermanence. Look at your concepts. Look at the thoughts you're attached to. Look at the concepts of physics. I mean, history is a great way of practicing. Look at the strongly held beliefs of physics over the last 100 years. Broken concepts, a whole trail of broken concepts. But they led to each other. And that's what happens in Buddhist practice. Our insights lead to the next and the next and the next.
Question was kind of a question of mine that I was, the comment was a sort of a question of mine, if I'm not interrupting you.
No.
That I was kind of avoiding, because when you said what's the, you know, your dyad practice, I was like, questions I have often seem to me like a, you know, kind of devil's advocate or something, like a divine argument or something.
Good. Those are the best.
I guess. I don't know. For me, when you said, what, how do I cling to things? And I was like, maybe that's how I cling to things, by Charlie's trying to argue. Anyway, I was thinking about impermanence, and just like, I think I've heard a physics explanation that no matter, that nothing disappears or something. Things change. I can't remember the quote. It's from like high school science class or something.
Yeah.
You know,
matter cannot be created nor destroyed.
Yeah, it changes. So that it's an impermanent, I suppose, in that sense. But then it's permanent in that it just changes into something else that still exists.
Well, if you can say the dance of matter to energy is permanence, but here it's matter, here it's energy. In fact, here it's matter, here it's energy simultaneously.
Right.
In fact, the wave is the particle simultaneously. No time difference. The wave is the particle. Depends on how you measure it, how you look at it, how we think about it. It's not permanent.
Right.
But in high school, we were taught something a little more comforting than that.
And then, I'm sorry, I forgot your name. You had the first question, Warren, I think, about, but I didn't really catch it. It was about celestial being. No, what was it?
Ephemeral.
And I don't know exactly what that means, but I have a feeling it relates to my other question, which was just the part of us that, you know, doesn't die when we die, whatever that is. which I don't know that there's any proof, but that seems like maybe more permanent too, or something.
Yeah.
Eternal awareness or eternal being.
Mm-hmm.
Being here.
Yeah, great questions. Ephemeral means basically, I think, that by the time you try to touch it, it's gone.
Okay.
Even though it appeared, you
right.
can't find its substance. It's changing that fast. Mm-hmm. And the only way we can talk about really what we die into and what dies and what's permanent there is to get into so many words it becomes philosophy. But you will be able to experience the truth of it, which is Buddha nature by one name, and the nature of mind by another, and the way of abiding by another, and God by another. There is something there. You will experience it if you really apply yourself to these practices. But it would be silly to try to talk about it, because you can read about a jillion books by people who've already tried to talk about it in different ways. And the words are just fingers pointing at the moon. And we get caught with believing the finger is the moon. So I'd rather not go there. But you can experience it partly just by the impermanence practices. You look at all these things that you've attached to and longed for and loved and held closely, and you relax into that and you experience something that kind of builds on itself, some kind of insight. So if we really understand that everyone dies, then compassion arises. And compassion is one of the qualities of Buddha nature. If I truly know that each one of you is dying and really integrate that into my very being, compassion arises. So a lot of things happen with these contemplations to the degree you work them.
Well, I think when I was younger, fear arose, and less than it does now.
Yeah.
And there's that dance between fear and the compassion.
There is. And fear arising is wonderful, because then if you're doing impermanence practice, you can watch whatever brought it up and see, is that permanent? No. And then you can look at the fear itself. Is that permanent?
Opportunity to learn.
Yeah, or have an insight about
insight.
It. But at least you see that even these things that scare us to death are evanescent, ephemeral, arising, appearing, going away all the time. Just like the wave and the particle. I want to make sure we've covered any pressing questions. It's a tough subject, and we could spend months on it. But it would be really good if everyone has a taste of practicing in daily life some of these things. When a poison arises, aversion, is it permanent? Is the object of it permanent? Is my response to it permanent? And so on down the line. Some of you are probably thinking that you now understand why Buddhists get a bad name for being so pessimistic. Any other questions, thoughts, reflections? Jim.
So much of my daily activities are, and have been, always have been, based on the assumption that much of what I am doing is in preparation for something unfolding later in a certain way, whether it's in the garden, you know? I mean, you're always looking ahead, 6 months, a year, whatever. And I understand that, I mean, I may not even be here a year from now, so, but on the other hand, I mean, on the one hand, that seems to be as though I'm holding on to this belief of permanence and that all these things are going to be here when I'm doing maintenance on the house for 10 years down the road or whatever. But on the other hand, I enjoy what I'm doing. And if, I mean, I have chosen carefully selected activities that I really enjoy doing and that I'm passionate about. And yet, if they're not there, they disappear, something happens, Moose knocks the fence down, and that's the end of the garden or whatever. It is what it is, you know? And I'm not going to argue with reality. I'm not going to want things to be other than the way they are. But on the other hand, I still have a kind of this underlying, not a belief in permanence, but continuity, I guess is the word that I'm using, which actually lies in the face of the impermanence that you're talking about.
Well, that's a great example.
So, I mean, I don't know that I really want to change anything that I'm doing, but on the other hand, maybe much of what I'm doing is reinforcing a fundamental belief in the permanence of things. You know, I'm not sure that...
The question is a beautiful one, really important, going to be hard to answer briefly, but what you describe is holding it lightly. You know that the house might fall down, the moose might eat your fruit trees. You go ahead and have some kind of activity anyway. One of the old teachers said, try to see the amusing side of initiating situations or activities. And what he's talking about is the light touch. Yes, I'm going to plant this tree. The chances I will be here to pick an apple from it are pretty darn slim. Yes, I'm going to cultivate my garden so that it'll be ready next year to plant. Great, as long as it's held with a light touch. See the amusing side of initiating situations. Light touch. Yes, have to live. We're in a body. We're living. It's changing all the time. But we still do things. This is a topic for another time, but in the Mahayana lineage of Buddhism, they answered this by coming up with the two truths, the relative truth of the presence, appearance, function of your garden and your activities in it, and the absolute appearance, the absolute truth of Buddha nature, meaning things appear and are simultaneously empty, particles simultaneously wave. So it appears, it has functions, it has characteristics, and at the same time, you actually can't find it. Same as in particle physics nowadays. So we do our daily activities rationally, but with a light touch. And it sounds to me like you're already doing that.
Somewhat, but I mean, on the other hand, I still go through momentary reactions to disasters
when
things don't work out. But it's much easier to let it go very quickly than it used to be. And I mean that
fruits of practice
is part of it. I'm just looking to refine it a little further, but I like the light touch and use them as you're doing things. I'm not always amused.
Join the club. And then you watch your responses arising. Which I know you're doing in your daily practice, and you can be amused at them, or you can just observe the poisons playing out without being totally, totally drowning in the emotions and the story of it.
I think it would be good to revisit this topic and relate it to other aspects of our lives. I think this was a good discussion. Because I want to connect it to intention. How that relates. And we don't have time. I'm not asking any to go any further with this, but I'm just saying there's a lot going on.
And I think even with intention, you can play with this old sage's advice to find the amusing side of initiating things.
Okay.
I have broken my promise to get us out of your quarter till. Great questions, and thank you very much for your participation. Let's just sit for a couple minutes. Mm-hmm.